For decades, John Luther Adams has been composing music inspired by nature. One of his early compositions was Songbird Songs. It'll be performed by Caballito Negro. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Yay. Tomorrow evening at 7:30 in the Music Recital Hall on the campus of Southern Oregon University. Joining me to discuss their performance are Tessa Brinkman and Terry Longshore. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you here. This is a fun piece. I went back, I heard it years ago. I'd mentioned earlier to you that I met John Luther Adams a long time ago in Alaska. And I went back yesterday and I listened to this piece. I hadn't heard it in quite a few years. Tell me a little bit about it, your performance tomorrow, anything you can let us know.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so the piece John wrote quite a while ago, actually. He wrote it between 1974 to 1980. And then he came back to it about not quite 10 years ago to kind of revisit it and made some edits, made some changes, and put it into the version that it is now. And it's inspired by Songbird's songs in rural Georgia, where he spent part of his life growing up and spent a lot of time. Of course, then he moved to Alaska and lived there for, you know, 30 plus years before moving to now living in New York City, where he also grew up as a child. But the song is inspired by the songs of birds in rural Georgia. And it's not a transcription of those songs, but it is a evocation of their music. And he scored it for two piccolo players who also play ocarina and three percussionists.
I think I'd like to listen to a clip of that right now that we have. This is it's not your performance specifically, is that correct?
Correct.
But somebody else that has been playing that. So, Darnell, if you could run that for us. Well, it certainly reminds you of songbirds, which is the intent, and that's good, right?
Yeah.
When I listen to this piece, besides just enjoying it, I like it to relax too, and just the sound, like I said, reminds me of songbirds. But the other thing that comes to my mind, I'm an amateur musician with a very strong emphasis on the word amateur, and I'm always amazed. How do you maintain your timing in a work like this, for maybe for any of John Luther Adams' works? That seems like a very difficult challenge.
Well, I think we, you know, have a sense of internal rhythm, or have our own time scale, because we're not all falling at 1 meter, you know. So, and he often has a range of tempi that we can be within. I mean, the idea I think he wants is for us to be natural, like as if we are birds in a forest. You know, and we have our own rhythms, but we're also having conversation with each other. But it's almost like being different characters, I think.
Well, tell me a little bit about who will be with you tomorrow night in this performance.
So we have Elizabeth McNutt, flutist from UNT in Texas. And we have Chris White from, well, two universities right now, Portland State and
Western Oregon.
And Jared Brown, who is a percussionist who lives also in Ashland, and he's also a composer. So all these very talented and wonderful musicians. It's a real joy to, create with them and create something that is always has this level of spontaneity. So you never quite know what's going to happen next. Even though there is a structure and there are instructions, there's always this kind of new patterns that emerge. So it makes it very exciting for us as musicians. Yeah.
Have you worked with these folks before on this particular piece or something else?
We both work with Jared a lot because Jared's a former student of Terry's.
I see.
Yeah, and Elizabeth and I went to graduate school together at University of California, San Diego. But that was, you know, a few years ago. And Chris and I have known each other for a bunch of years now and have collaborated at festivals together, producing things. But this is, I think, the first time we've actually played together. So that's exciting.
Well, tell me a little bit about your group, how you came to work together and what you perform, how often, any information about just yourselves as a group.
So as a duo, we decided to become a duo, I think it was 2007, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our focus has been really music that we both just love. I mean, that's, I know it sounds rather amorphous, but there's so much music out there that has been written and is yet to be written that expresses a lot of joy and pathos and communion with an audience, and that's what we're really interested in. And we often have themes that we explore in concerts that are sort of, it's a kind of a curation of sorts. So, for example, our program that we'll be doing next year is called Alone Together, and its theme is science fiction, actually, which we've performed in Portland already, but it's a really fun and moving, I think, concert that explores futurism and our future, which, as you can imagine, is like quite the topic right now because of all the turmoil that's going on. So we get to explore that musically as well as narratively.
I was going to ask, is there a lot of good music out there today? Are there a lot of good composers that are working, things that you're really excited about? Do you look for, even though you mentioned kind of broadly what you like, do you look for particular genres or how things are put together?
Well, we look primarily for people we're very interested in collaborating with. The relationship with the person, the composer, with our collaborators is very important to us, as well as the music, of course. So, for instance, a project we are cooking up right now is a collaboration and commission from composer Alex Shapiro. Alex, she lives in San Juan, on the San Juan Island in Puget Sound. And she's a composer who, like John Luther Adams, is very influenced by environmentalism and nature and writes just incredible music. And she's also a brilliant, wonderful person who we both have gotten to know and are very excited. So we're working on a project right now that we hope to be able to announce fairly soon that could involve some of our own natural environment here in the Rogue Valley.
We're joined this morning by Tessa Brinkman and Terry Longshore of Caballito Negro. Am I getting closer to saying that
you
right?
You certainly are.
I'm working on my Spanish, right? We'd like to invite you to join us for the conversation as well. If you have any questions about tomorrow night's performance, again, that's at the Music Recital Hall here at Southern Oregon University. You can call us at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. Do you bring in a lot of guest musicians as well as being a duo?
We've started to do that. I mean, we love collaboration, and the relationship is everything to what we do because, you know, it's just magical when someone is, when there's a spirit of generosity and people are wanting to build something that is outside of their own experience too, so that you're all contributing and you all are really deeply listening. That's one of the most thrilling things that I think can happen to a person creatively.
This is more of a high-tech question that just kind of popped into my mind when you collaborate with musicians who are living in different places. Do you guys do this electronically sometimes, or do you always have to be in the same space in order to practice?
Well, the technology, I don't think, permits really a sort of secure way of really collaborating remotely, even though in preparation we will do things like Skype, like we've been Skyping with Alex Shapiro, for example. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's not to say that we wouldn't do that. It's just that technology has to really serve the performance, and I don't see that it's there yet.
Yeah, there's some experimenting with that now, people who are collaborating via, you know, network wires and things in live performance. And not something we've experimented with yet, but not to say that we might not in the future.
Yeah, the technology gets, when we have holograms of each other in the rooms.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's also something to be said of, you know, going out to coffee with your collaborators and hanging out and having a beer afterwards and stuff like that, which is pretty important to us as well.
It's really important, actually. It's the space between what you do and what, you know, it's the quiet moments that the revelations come and the intimacy with the people that you're working with. And the trust, really, because when you have that deep, deep trust, then you have that psychic communion, and then something extraordinary can happen. So that kind of thing makes us very happy.
I know that in the case of Adam's compositions, you know, you talk about space, quiet space. There's a lot of openness in his compositions, and that reminds me of my home of Alaska. No matter where he writes his stuff, I think Alaska when he does that. Is that something that you really like to embrace as a duo in your music? Do you look for things that have just, I don't know what the right word is even in the musical profession, but where it just kind of breathes and you have some openness and you have quiet between the notes?
Absolutely. And I guess a term you could use would be ambience, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Space is important. I mean, space determines how the notes sound. So that is the music. So...
Yeah, and I think another important quality is texture to us. Texture, mm-hmm. color, things of that sort that are adjectives that aren't always immediately associated with music but can be important descriptors of how the music feels to both perform and to mm-hmm. listen to. And in John's music, certainly there is a lot of space. There's a lot of grandiosity. There's also a lot of serene, quiet, beautiful moments. And in this piece, Songbird Songs, there's a lot of contrast like that. There are 9 movements. The piece is 45 minutes to an hour in length. And the movements contrast quite greatly, both in their texture, how he uses the instruments. There's a massive battery of percussion instruments that the 3 percussionists play to really provide a lot of contrast between the different movements.
Well, let me ask for folks who would be coming to the concert tomorrow night, what do they need to bring in terms of their own mental space and what to expect and how they can most enjoy the concert?
Themselves.
Just themselves.
Yeah, an open mind and a willingness to participate.
All right.
And that can be in a variety of different ways. You know, people enjoy and participate in a musical dialogue in different ways, and we welcome all of that.
We have another clip that we'd like to play, and this is another performance. Do you want to set this up a little bit and tell us about it?
So you're talking about William Craft's Close Encounters?
That's correct.
So this piece we recorded a few years ago, and actually Bill's a close friend of Terry's, so you can talk more about that.
Sure. William Craft, Bill, is... composer and percussionist. He was with the Los Angeles Philharmonic for 26 years as composer in residence, principal timpanist, associate conductor. And we've collaborated with him here at SOU many times, had him out as guest artist and worked on his music together. Tessa and I premiered this piece called Encounters 16. It's a duo for flute and percussion and is a good introduction to, you know, one of the styles of music that we play, but certainly not exclusive to that. And a contrast, you know, certainly from the same camp in many ways as John Luther Adams' music, but following a little bit different thread of influence. Perhaps Bill's music might come a little more directly influenced from Stravinsky and Debussy, composers like that. And John, certainly with Stravinsky coming before, is highly influenced by composers like Morton Feldman, John Cage, and Lou Harrison.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear that clip. When you work closely with a composer, Are you? Do they work almost like a director would be on a movie? I mean, we have the notes on the page, and you know, those who can read music can try to interpret it. Well, what did this particular artist really want? If you don't have an opportunity to ever hear their performance, but how does that work when you're working really closely with a composer?
Well, it depends on the person. I would liken it to a marriage, perhaps in this case, a three-way marriage. And, you know, what you're looking for is, you know, a sense of generosity and openness and communion, basically. So there's going to be some back and forth about decisions about how you interpret. And those marriages can end up well or they can end up badly. It all depends. We look for good marriages. I mean,
it's not a honeymoon forever.
No, it's not. But it's one, you know, it can be tricky for, I mean, you can see it from the perspective, like a marriage, from every person's point of view. So the composer pours their heart into this piece. They don't know how it's going to sound. They hope like hell that someone will play it well and do what they envision. But often what happens to a composition is it doesn't sound the way that they thought it was. You know, just because it's been in their head and it gets faster and faster. And often the tempi they put on a score is faster than actually what it should be played, often because they're working on MIDI or because it's in their head.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have to learn, and experienced composers will do this, they learn to disengage from their preconceptions of what they think their piece is to when they give that baby over to, say, us, you know, allowing that piece to find its feet and identity again. And that can be hard for some composers. Other composers say, that's fine, you know, I gave birth to this piece, now it's going to wander its way around the world, hopefully, and have life in different hands and different experiences. So it requires a lot of good listening in a personal sense and attention to detail. And the willingness also to justify your opinions about why you think something should go somewhere and the depth of reasoning behind that. I mean, all of those things are important.
And do some are some composers pretty open-minded about suggested changes? If you say, like, boy, I just really would rather do this way, do they respond pretty well?
I found that. Generally, they are. And usually when they say, I absolutely cannot change that, I don't want to change that, you know that they're right because there's some. It's part of the structure of the piece. I mean, you can sort of tell when a composer is just being, you know, stubborn or something versus saying, is following the integrity of what the reason why they came up with something. But usually it doesn't come down to some kind of conflict, usually, because all through the process, you've been following the reasoning of why this person's piece has come into being.
I have a friend who's he just as strictly as a hobby, he directs a local small orchestra in the town he lives in, and he'll write a couple of compositions, fairly traditional classical type compositions, and the instruments that you would find. These are probably mostly adults who played the saxophone in high school, you know, and they want to keep that going. And I find it interesting because he will use software to simulate the instruments. You can have your fake cello in the software, and he'll send that out to us who are friends of his just to get some feedback. And then I've had a couple opportunities to then hear the local little orchestra play live, and how much more alive the live is and how much better it sounds. You know, we can only get this sort of artificial impression of what's being done compared to that. And I really think it must be important to just get that sort of, even if you're a composer, that live sense of being able to work with someone.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, the computer musical notation is such a wonderful tool, but it certainly has its limitations, you know, and especially in the playback of what it's going to sound like. And a composer like John Luther Adams, for instance, you know, he has many different styles of music in his compositional body. This particular piece, Songbird Songs, as Tessa alluded to earlier, it's not traditional in the sense that everybody starts on the left top edge of the page and moves along linearly. We all have little phrases followed by pauses, and we can, most of the time in the piece, play those phrases in any order in which we want. and wait as long as we want, almost in between those phrases. And so there's a lot of responsibility, power, decision-making, et cetera, that's given to the performers by the composer. And I find that's a real gift. It can be a different kind of pressure. You know, there's the pressure of playing a piece exactly like it's written in a traditional sense, of getting everything right in exactly the right time. In a piece like Songbird Songs, it's playing each of those little cells exactly right every time you play them, but it's also then the responsibility of, I need to play it in the most wonderful place I can every time, you know, and does that mean I'm waiting and listening to one of my other players and coming, you know, answering them, or am I intentionally kind of stepping on their toes sometimes to create a thicker texture? And so there's a lot of that going on in our heads as we're playing, and much of that is happening right in the moment. We're listening to each other, we're reading our music, responding to each other, and making those decisions. So it's an interesting blend of, you know, performing a composition as written and, in a sense, improvising in a way, although we're not improvising the notes at all.
That really speaks to the genius of Adams, too, because if you can imagine being, you know, in a forest, I mean, animals don't follow a script. They're literally fighting for their survival, and they're always, you know, microsecond to microsecond figuring out where to be and how to relate. So we're sort of, in a sense, we are those characters.
I was going to ask, with this particular composition, is there a theme to it? Even though, of course, there's no lyrics, right? But is there a theme to this song, or is it just something to be experienced and enjoyed?
Well, there's nine movements, and each of them has a title that's pulled from a naturalistic inspiration. So I'll just give you the titles very quickly. Wood Thrush, Morning Field Song, Meadow Dance, August Voices, Morning Dove, Apple Blossom Round, Not Quite Spring Dawn, Joyful Noise, and Even Song. And even within those nine titles, some of them are names of birds, but only a couple. Some of them are evocations of naturalistic settings. And some of them, like Even Song, is a, you know, traditional form of music. So
we've been speaking this morning with Tessa Brinkman and Terry Longshore of Caballito Negro. You'll be performing tomorrow night in the Music Recital Hall here at SOU at 7:30. Thanks so much for being here this morning.
Thanks so much for having us.